what can we afford and what's reasonable in an era of tightening our belts? What can we reasonably expect to be able to give to support this?
The Walker administration previews its position on oil tax credits. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage's new police chief sets his priorities, including community policing.
I'm going to work with the community and ask them to help identify their neighbors, their family members, and persuade them to commit to public service.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
The state and federal governments have decided not to pursue $92 million in additional damages from ExxonMobil Corporation. The governments say ducks and sea otters have recovered in Alaska's Prince William Sound following a devastating oil spill more than two decades ago. Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder informed legislators of the decision today in an email, a copy of which was obtained by the Associated Press. A department spokesman wouldn't confirm the decision, saying an announcement would be made later today. Lawsuits brought against Exxon by the state and federal governments after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill led to a $900 million settlement and a consent decree that resolved claims related to natural resource damages. The decree included a clause that would allow the governments to seek additional funds for restoration projects, up to $100 million. The clause was called a reopener, and a case had been scheduled for a court hearing tomorrow. With the state looking at a deficit next year of more than $3 billion, lawmakers face the always vexing question of what can be cut. One option on the table is reducing tax credits for oil and gas companies. Today, lawmakers gave a preview of the debate coming in January. From the Energy Desk, APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
The Senate Oil and Gas Tax Credit Working Group has the kind of name that puts anyone but the most hardcore policy wonk to sleep. But as with so many things in state government, behind that patina of boring is a whole lot of important. The issue before the group, always contentious, is how Alaska should tax its oil and gas companies. Right now, the state offers tax credits as incentives to get companies to come to Alaska, produce oil and gas, and generate jobs and economic activity. But with the drop in oil prices, those credits are looking out of balance. Last year, the state paid out almost $630 million in credits while collecting just about $300 million in production taxes. Governor Bill Walker argues the state simply can't afford that, especially when it's making deep cuts elsewhere. Tax Director Ken Alpert made that case to the working group.
It has to come down to what can we afford and what's reasonable in an era of tightening our belts. What can we reasonably expect to be able to give to support this?
Production taxes aren't the only source of oil revenue. The state collected another $1.7 billion, mostly in royalties, though also in property and corporate taxes. But historically, production taxes have been the workhorse of the state budget. The working group was convened by Anchorage Republican Kathy Giesel, who chairs the Senate Resources Committee. Giesel called the tax credits foundational to Alaska's oil tax system. Changing them changes the whole game, she said.
You talked about economic opportunity, and these credits create that economic opportunity for the smaller companies to come in and develop our resources. And we, in turn, benefit from that.
Tuesday's session focused on credits for companies working on the North Slope, and Pat Galvin, an executive at Great Bear and former state revenue commissioner, explained how credits have helped his company.
A company's going to have a certain amount of capital they're allowed to spend, they have available to them to spend, and what the tax credits provide is a multiplier effect of allowing you to do more activity with the money that you have available to you.
The administration hasn't yet finalized its proposals for changes to the system. Alper laid out a list of options, including reducing the amount of credits and allowing the state to release more information about how much money goes to which companies. But he says, bottom line, the current system is unsustainable.
Because not only is it $700 million a year now, it could be $1.5 billion a year 5 years from now if some of the larger entities that have been looking for oil find oil and start developing it. And where exactly are we going to come up with $1 billion, $1.5 billion a year?
And that's a question for which nobody had an answer. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is raising serious money for her re-election bid next year, despite having no serious challenger yet. Campaign coordinator Scott Kendall said today that total contributions for the previous 3 months were close to $1 million.
In the third quarter of the year, we raised over $920,000.
All told, Murkowski has raised more than $3 million for the 2016 election and has $2 million on hand. Kendall, the only full-time campaign staffer so far, says they don't plan to open campaign offices until next year, but could mobilize sooner if needed. As of today, no challenger has filed with the Federal Election Commission, which is mandatory for any candidate who raises more than $5,000. Still, Kendall says Murkowski has to be ready.
It's important to remember the filing deadline is not until early June of next year. So up until that date, we have to plan that we will have a challenger both in the primary and the general.
In 2010, when Murkowski lost the Republican primary to challenger Joe Miller, Miller didn't announce his candidacy until April of that year. Murkowski retained her Senate seat with a write-in campaign. Kendall says they've received hundreds of contributions from Alaska, but he acknowledges she is looking outside the state for money.
The senator has certainly been fundraising, yes, and certainly with her position as chair of Energy and Natural Resources, energy companies, many of which who do business and create jobs here in Alaska, are certainly interested in supporting her.
At least twice in the past 2 years, Murkowski has missed votes in the Senate while raising campaign cash in Texas. Anchorage has a new police chief. Earlier this week, former DEA Special Agent Chris Tolley took over from Chief Mark Mew, who'd been with the city in various positions for more than 3 decades. Mew presided over the department during one of its most politically embattled periods, and as KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, is handing the force off with clear guidance on where it needs to go.
A big part of Mew's legacy, and one he's proud of, is how the department communicates with the public it serves through measures like EPD's Nixle Alerts, those miniature press releases that get sent straight to inboxes and smartphones around the city.
You know, we didn't used to share that kind of stuff.
It's not transparency for its own sake. Mew sees a good relationship with the community as a practical necessity for an effective police force. But a term like community policing is a little bit fuzzy, and along with staffing, it's become a buzzword the last few years as the police force has been used like a football in Anchorage's city politics. Mew wants to have enough officers on staff that about 40% of their time is unobligated, meaning they can build relationships and cases rather than just scrambling to the next call.
I think that's what we mean when we mean proactive community policing. And I think and I hope that my successor is going to have the opportunity to maximize those kind of notions.
I am Chris Tolley. What you probably want to know about me is 3 things. Number one, I'm a husband and a father. I'm a neighbor. And then I'm also dedicated my life to public service through law enforcement.
As of this week, Tolley is the city's new police chief. He's been in charge of the Drug Enforcement Agency's operations in Alaska the last few years, but his career started as a police officer in Baltimore during the 70s.
Handled just about every type of crime you can imagine, anything from simple loitering to rapes and homicides.
Not that that doesn't sound hard and terrifying, but what made you switch then to DEA after?
Good question. I actually felt a little ambitious and thought that I wanted to go into federal government service. So I actually left the police department and went to law school for a short period of time. And that was in San Diego, and that's where I was recruited by DEA.
Tolley liked that even as a junior agent at DEA, he could take lead on a case. He worked operations getting rid of marijuana crops from helicopters in Hawaii, held several different appointments in far-flung offices around the globe, and eventually looped back to lead the domestic cannabis eradication program at DEA headquarters in 2009. But he says the public shouldn't read into his resume that he's out to crack down on marijuana users in Anchorage during his tenure. Instead, he says his past with DEA gives him insights into how to tackle complex cases involving organized crime, money laundering, gun violations, all of which brings up one very important question.
Switching gears just a bit, how is any of this relevant to running a local police department and community policing?
Well, when you walk into a DA office, you're going to see a number of people and you're going to think, oh, they're all agents of the federal government and so on. Not so.
Tully says that because DEA in Alaska regularly partners with the detectives from APD, the troopers, airport police, and other federal agencies, he's accustomed to multifaceted investigations with a wide array of partners. His version of community policing, similar to his predecessors, starts with rebuilding the size of the police force. But a challenge the department faces is filling those police academies, particularly with people who reflect Anchorage's own diversity. Tully says that is where his community policing mandate begins.
The real challenge will be with the community. I'm going to work with the community and ask them to help identify their neighbors, their family members, and persuade them to commit to public service.
And is that like at the community council level, in schools, like door knocking? What do you mean when you say that?
Every opportunity we get, such as right now, I'm going to take advantage of the opportunity. Anybody interested in knowing more about becoming a police officer, please go to joinapd.org.
The department is taking the rare step of holding three academies within 1 year. Applications for the spring session are now being accepted. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new bridge safely connects the North and South Shore residents of Alegnagik for the first time.
It's just amazing. Nothing that I've ever imagined would ever happen when I started school here in 1951.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
A forensic psychologist took the stand at the Fairbanks 4 hearing yesterday. University of Washington psychology professor Jeffrey Loftus testified at the original John Hartman murder trials in 1999, at which the Fairbanks 4 were convicted of fatally beating the teen. Loftus was back in court as the four seek exoneration. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Dr. Jeffrey Loftus' testimony is specific to the claim of Fairbanks resident Arlo Olson, who said he saw the Fairbanks Four assault another man shortly before the October 1997 John Hartman attack. The claim was pivotal in the men's convictions. Loftus told the court that Olson's alleged long-distance identification of the Fairbanks Four mugging Frank Dayton near the Eagles Hall inspired him to conduct research after the trials.
To calibrate the amount of blurring that is associated with the amount of distance.
Loftus referred to a resulting formula and computer program that demonstrate Olson's alleged identification of the four men at a distance of 550 feet is suspect.
Assuming that a person is 550 feet away, you end up with a blurred image that I think everybody would agree would be impossible to recognize.
Loftus says such an identification is even more unlikely under conditions of Olson's alleged sighting, including darkness and alcohol impairment. State Attorney Bob Linton contested the science relied on by Loftus, alleging there are other factors that could have aided Olson's ID of the suspects.
He actually talked to them before he observed an attack on Frankie Dayton.
Yes.
Right. And he knew two of them, Mr. Vent and Mr. Freeze, from beforehand.
Yes.
Arlo Olson testified last week that he was heavily coached by police about his story of what happened the night of the assaults on Dayton and Hartman. Olson is expected to return to the stand. Judge Paul Lyle is hearing all case evidence and determining what to consider in ruling on the Fairbanks 4 exoneration request. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The vast majority of people who are incarcerated have substance abuse issues, and that abuse is often a cause for recidivism. One solution, get them treatment quickly. A new program in Anchorage is trying to do just that using a new, little-used drug called Vivitrol. But not all providers are convinced it's the best option. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman found out more.
Vivitrol is a monthly injection that stops a person's cravings for opiates and for alcohol. If you use heroin or drink liquor while you're on it, you won't get high. Family nurse practitioner Jill Green's goal is to get people on the drug as soon as they leave the prison system.
Keeping them on that Vivitrol, it helps calm down the brain so that they're not constantly thinking about, where's my next hit coming from. You know, I'm going to need my next fix.
Green says that way they can focus on getting jobs, housing, and treatment. As part of her doctorate program in nursing practice at UAA, Green is working with the Partners Reentry Center to help people get the medication as quickly as possible. For those who have chosen to participate, she's been able to get them the injection within 2 hours at her clinic. Similar programs are popping up all over the country. Some are administering Vivitrol in jails, others in drug courts. Fred Moses is a municipal judge in Hocking County, Ohio, a rural area in Appalachia with high heroin usage and limited access to treatment facilities. In 2012, he created a drug court where offenders were given monthly injections of Vivitrol, along with drug abuse treatment and other court-mandated requirements. Since then, 90 different people have come through his Vivitrol court. Only one has reoffended.
Well, these are not first-time offenders. I've taken the hardcore users. And what they tell me is that I want to read a book. And why that's significant is that their brains are clear. They're not going out and needing the drug. They don't have a withdrawal. They don't have a need for a narcotic. So the treatment goes much better.
Moses says within 3 to 6 months on the drug, his participants have all of the narcotics out of their system. They're clear-headed enough to really respond to treatment and to focus on the causes of their drug addictions.
The shot's a great tool, but the key is still treatment. No matter what it is, it's still treatment. And I won't ever change my mind about that.
And that's part of the problem. Green says people on Vivitrol who are not court-mandated to use it, like the group she's working with, have to be willing to get treatment at the same time and to come back to the clinic to get their shot again the next month.
Vivitrol, if you don't take the shot, well, you can just go out and use again. There's no harm in coming off Vivitrol. It's not painful. You don't feel anything. You just don't go get your next shot.
Psychiatrist Aria Levinson has run an opiate addiction clinic for 5 years at South Central Foundation. He thinks Vivitrol works well for some patients, but it has limitations. People have to detox before they can use it, and sometimes Vivitrol causes flu-like symptoms. But one of the biggest hurdles is that patients on Vivitrol don't always come back.
I think when folks are not craving or not experiencing a missing or needing of the drug that they were using, there's often a sense that I've overcome this, I've cured my problem, I don't need treatment anymore.
And then they relapse. So Levinson often uses another more popular alternative, Suboxone, which combines a synthetic opiate with another drug that also blocks the cravings. Levinson says he requires his Suboxone patients to receive substance abuse treatment and work on getting their life in order before he'll give them another prescription.
And for people who said that they were willing and started on Suboxone and then did not follow through with their commitments, we did not continue giving them the Suboxone. So we had a very tight, as you might say, a carrot and a stick approach.
He says they also monitor Suboxone users to make sure they're taking the drug and not selling it on the street, which is a common problem. Alaska Wellness Court Program Coordinator Jennifer Fredericks says that in drug courts in Alaska, they prefer to use Vivitrol or the pill form of the same drug.
We have tried to work with participants that have been on Suboxone, but we've found it difficult due to how addictive that medication is.
She says drug court participants on Suboxone often come to court high, and that triggers the other participants. The program has only been using Vivitrol for about a year, so they don't have data on success rates yet. But Frederick says she sees positive changes, especially with young heroin addicts. Because Vivitrol is so new, it's unclear how long people have to use it. Recommendations range from 3 months to a year, depending on the individual. Shots can cost around $1,000 per month or more, but can be paid for with some insurance and with Medicaid. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com.
Governor Bill Walker announced today the creation of an 11-member tribal advisory council.
So we need to do things differently. We need to do things collaboratively.
We need to have the vehicle to have a discussion and bring things to us. And so when we have an issue, we have a mechanism to go out to the village leaders to solicit your input.
The council will advise on a wide range of concerns from education to economic development. There will be a representative for each issue. Richard Peterson is a president of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Of all the issues covered by the council, Peterson says energy should be a priority. But land into trust is also something he'd like to see addressed before too long.
Obviously, they recognize tribes and their importance, but, you know, there's never been a formal recognition. And I think that needs to take place because, what I would hate is to have all this great forward movement under this administration and then another administration comes in and just ignores, you know, and it's back to the way it was previously where tribes didn't have the impact that we have now.
Walker made the announcement today at the Alaska Federation of Natives and National Congress of American Indians annual conference in Anchorage. The Alegnagik Wood River Bridge is complete and opened yesterday. The bridge connects the North Shore residents of Alegnagik with the South Shore and the road to Dillingham. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
As far back as people remember, at least a dozen people have died making the short crossing of Lake Alegnagik, most of them falling through the ice, which is unreliable in the winter and perilous during the shoulder seasons. By boat, snowgo, or four-wheeler, middle and high school students cross every day to attend school in Dillingham. Then there are the medical emergencies and the routine daily crossings by others to get to work or just get groceries.
It's harder on the elders and the school kids going across every day and take risk in their lives, actually. This year is the most blessing thing that happened for the younger generation.
That's North Shore resident Bob Christensen, who says his knees used to shake as he crossed the ice or choppy waters when he first moved to Alegnagik 8 years ago. For some, like Molly Chythla, cutting the ribbon on the bridge Tuesday was a little longer coming.
It's just amazing. Nothing that I've ever imagined would ever happen when I started school here in 1951.
As of the last head count, there were 248 people living in Alegnagik, a slight majority of them on the North Shore. The city says the community is growing, and while a lot of that growth has been occurring on the South Shore, some of the momentum is expected to shift across the lake with the convenience of the new bridge. About 200 people gathered for the official opening Tuesday. Mayor Jane Gottschalk, DOT Commissioner Mark Lucan, Senator Lyman Hoffman, and Representative Bryce Edgman had the honor of cutting the ribbon. It took just 2 years to build the bridge, a far shorter amount of time than it took to get the funding, the permits, and the land access to start construction. While Senator Hoffman is given much of the credit for making sure the estimated $25 million was available to see it completed, in his remarks Tuesday, he called attention to decades worth of local efforts by countless others.
It is the determination of all the people of this area and their persistence to make sure that the bridge wasn't forgotten and continued to be a high priority. And look at this wonderful, beautiful bridge. It warms my heart to see it.
The bridge spans across and only touches twice the Wood River, one of the most productive sockeye salmon rivers in the world. DOT Commissioner Lucan offered some of the technical specifications.
It's a 440-foot bridge. It's 40 feet above the river. And it is going to be here, you know, based on the design, it's going to be here for well over 100 years. It is a well-designed, well-built bridge.
While optimism was the prevailing mood of the day, there's still an apprehension voiced quietly by North Shore residents. The bridge opens easier access to their quiet neighborhood, trails, and resources, and they admit they're a little leery of the traffic coming north from Dillingham. They also say they've been advised to start locking their doors for the first time ever. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Savico Park and Gastineau Elementary School will be the future sites of two totem poles, part of a three-year project of healing. Interpretive signs in Tlingit and English will explain the history of the original people of Juneau and Douglas. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
In 1956, the site of the Douglas Indian Cemetery was paved over near the elementary school, and the Douglas Indian Village was burned in 1962 to make way for a new harbor. Signs near Savico Park explain the history of the Treadwell Mine, but there's nothing about the area's native people. Now there's a project to change that. It's called A Time for Healing.
Agawu Yeshtusnechji.
That's Marcia Hotch. She works for the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. The organization was awarded over $1 million from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. John Morris of the Taku Kwan saw his village destroyed back in 1962.
In my lifetime, I have not seen a new totem pole placed in Douglas, so that's really good news.
Morris is a tribal leader in the Douglas Indian Association, and he's on the design team for the totems. As the final plans come together, he says he doesn't want the poles to reflect anything negative. It's not what the poles are historically intended to do.
My vision of the totem pole is going to be more of a welcome totem pole, you know, with the crest figures of the Taku Kwan Yanyedi people, which would be eagle-wolf design.
He says the poles could also include other native people in the area, like the Akwan and Wushkitan. The other part of the grant helps fund exhibits at the Juno Douglas Museum. The carving of the totems will be documented through photos and videos. Later, an $18,000 touch table can provide museum-goers with an interactive experience.
For example, if it's a map, if it were a map of the Douglas Indian Village, you could touch a portion of it and zooms into a part of the screen. So it's however you program it.
Richard Steele wrote the grant. He's been working with Jane Lindsay, the museum's director, on how technology can play a role. Lindsay came up with the idea of the touch table after seeing something similar in the Haynes Library. And she's excited the stories of the Ak and Taku Kwan will be featured in a permanent exhibit.
You know, we're looking at some pretty important history in Douglas and for the Douglas Indian Village and for all of the local native people here that we really need to talk about.
The totems are slated to go up in 2017, and the touch table is planned for 2018. A time for healing culminates in a community-wide celebration later that year. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes, and Jennifer Canfield in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Elegnagik, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.